This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode 32, and I just want to start by welcoming any new listeners to the podcast. I know we're getting a few because you've reached out to me, and I'm really glad you found the podcast. And those that have been listening for a while, as always, thank you, and please keep spreading the word. We have a great show for you today. I'm very excited about it. I've been thinking a lot about, I direct a community counseling practice, and I do a lot of supervision. And a theme that has been kind of something I've been thinking a lot about recently is this idea of therapeutic relationship or way of being. I prefer this idea of way of being better. But I've been thinking a lot about how do we teach these things? I think at this point we can all agree, those of us in the psychotherapy world, we can all agree that therapeutic relationship is a critical element to effective therapy. I think that, if N equals one, that's my experience, but also I think the research is showing that as well, and it's very, very important. But we're still in an environment where a lot of our workshops are model-based or technique-based, or, even in narrative practice, we do a lot of work around developing questions, and all of that's great. I want to be clear about that. All of that's great and helpful, but I'm also curious about how do we, how are we asking the questions? Even though we may have, some really great questions to ask, how are we asking the questions? And when we're in the midst of doing the work, what is supporting our creativity in that moment? And how will people that consult with us experience us as present or curious or compassionate? And so all of these ideas are very important to me because they're not teaching them in grad school. We know that. So I'm interested in how to begin to really kind of talk about and maybe learn or start to teach these ideas. We have a training in my clinic coming up on way of being, and I'm going to start experimenting with this idea. So that leads me to our guest. I found our guest, Dr. Ronald Epstein, MD. I found his book recently, his book is titled Attending Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. I found it on a fluke. Picked it up. I knew it was had something to say to me as I was flipping through it, and I bought it and I read it and I thought it was a great book, and I reached out to Dr. Epstein and he's going to be here today, and I think you're going to get a lot out of this. He's talking about a lot of these ideas and how to begin to kind of teach these ideas. His book is kind of pointed more towards physicians, but I think if you're a therapist, family therapist, relational therapist, you really would get a lot out of this book, and I think you're going to really get a lot out of this podcast as well. So let's not waste any more time, but before we get to the interview, let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Ronald Epstein. Dr. Epstein is a practicing family physician and a professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, where he directs the Center for Communication and Disparities Research and co-directs mindful practice programs. He is an internationally recognized educator, writer, and researcher whose landmark article, Mindful Practice, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1999, has revolutionized physicians' view of their work. Dr. Epstein has been named one of America's best doctors every year since 1998 by U.S. News and World Report. And he's written quite a book. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Epstein. All right. Dr. Epstein, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. I guess I want to start by just telling you a little story. I wasn't familiar with your work, and I was in Barnes & Noble recently, and the new releases table, which I kind of always browse, was there, and I came across your book, and the title of your book, Attending Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity, kind of just captured me, and I kind of started to flip through it a little bit, and I thought, I want to read this, and I took it home promptly and started reading this book, and I thought this is a really important book because it's capturing a lot of what I've been thinking a lot about in therapy, because there's a lot of research in therapy about what makes for effective therapy, and you know the overriding factor tends to be therapeutic relationship, and which is fine, but there's not anybody talking about how to do these kinds of things that make for effective relationships with clients, right? And I think your book, even though it might be geared towards physicians, your book really starts to kind of dig into some of these ideas about how to do what I call way of being better, right? And so, so I want to say first, thank you for writing the book. I think it's an important book, and I have a particular mission to let everybody know about it. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. But I guess I would start, my first question for you would be, if you start the book describing a couple experiences you had featuring two different kinds of doctors when you were a medical student. And I wonder if you could kind of share share a little bit about those experiences that set the stage for this book.
Yeah, well, I guess I want to respond, before I tell the stories, to a couple of things that you said,
sure.
Which is that it has to do with a therapeutic relationship. I think there are really two relationships here. Mm-hmm. One is your relationship with your patient or the person you're taking care of. And the second is the relationship of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
So it's the way that you cultivate and take care of yourself in the same way that you would cultivate and take care of someone who is suffering. And in my view, they're parallel processes. And whether you're a therapist or a physician, or for that matter, if you're a lawyer or an architect or anyone who interacts with other humans, it really involves that looking outside in the world and developing those relationships and looking inside yourself and knowing yourself better.
Mm.
So that's what the book is about fundamentally. And what I noticed early on in my training as a physician was that there are doctors who are better at being aware of who they were and what they were doing than others. And this particularly comes to a head at times of difficulty, of times of stress, these what I call boundary situations where someone's suffering intensely, where things aren't going right, where you're feeling this disconnect between what you hope you're doing and what's actually happening. And so I start the book out with a tale of two surgeons, because in surgery, when you're not paying attention, it's incredibly obvious. In other branches of medicine, you can kind of get away with things a little bit.
Sure.
But when you're not, it's kind of like I started out life as a musician, and when you're performing on stage and you're not really there, the audience knows it. And I imagine that you're a therapist, and I imagine to some degree your clients might know or might not, but I think in music and in surgery, it's just right out there. It's just really obvious. So the two situations I describe both involve surgical mishaps. The first one is where a surgeon is doing what's called a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection. That's a lot of words for removing the lymph nodes around both kidneys and the aorta. And this was in an 18-year-old who had cancer, and they had to remove those lymph nodes to see if they were cancerous, first of all, to take them out, and second of all, to see what stage the disease was at, because the treatment would be different if they found cancerous lymph nodes as opposed to if they were all clean. But it's really difficult surgery because the lymph nodes are small and they're next to all these vital structures, and things can get twisted and turned in the wrong ways. And that's exactly what happened, is one of the kidneys got twisted on its pedicle and it blocked the blood flow. And I noticed in the operating room that the kidney started turning blue. And I had a pretty good view of that kidney. The surgeon was on the other side of the table and it was more in his peripheral vision. And I knew the kind of unwritten rules as a medical student that you don't talk in the operating room. You kind of silently observe and you're not really part of the conversation. But I knew enough at that point that pink was good and blue was bad. And so I felt like there was something going on that really wasn't quite right. So I spoke up, and the surgeon completely ignored me. He was so focused on that other kidney that not only didn't he see the blue kidney, the first kidney that was blue, but he also didn't really register what I was saying. And probably my credibility wasn't great because I was just a third-year medical student, and what do third-year medical students know anyway? Anyway, a few minutes later, the kidney started turning a dusky purple. And there I knew something was really wrong. So I mentioned it to the scrub nurse next to me, and who mentioned it to the intern, who mentioned it to the surgeon. And the surgeon panicked. Even though it was within his field of vision before, he suddenly registered, uh-oh, something's wrong here. So he tried to untwist the kidney unsuccessfully, then had to call in a vascular surgeon who had to very delicately make an incision in the artery, remove the part of the inner part of the artery that got torn, and sew it up. Again, it's a very delicate operation. It took him about an hour to do that. And restored blood flow to the kidney, but not before the kidney registered some damage on blood tests afterwards. But the stunning thing for me was next day on rounds, the surgeon was there in the room with the patient and his mother and explained that an unavoidable complication had occurred. Mm-hmm. Now, the kidney getting twisted may have been unavoidable, but his response was not. And I suspect in retrospect that this was a highly competent surgeon at a very good hospital. And I suspect that this had never happened before, so it was a surprise. It didn't kind of register on his radar screen. And probably he had some idea that, you know, maybe this kind of thing could happen to some other surgeon, but it couldn't happen to me. You know, it couldn't happen in my OR.
Right.
And you know, I never had a chance to deconstruct this with that surgeon because I was a medical student. I never saw him again. But it really stuck with me. And then, so later in that rotation, I saw another surgeon who was doing another equally delicate operation. He was replacing part of a clogged aorta, the part where the aorta splits into two blood vessels that are the main blood vessels going down into the legs. It's what's called an aortobifemoral bypass. So he was removing those parts of the blood vessels and replacing them with a Dacron graft, a synthetic graft, so that the patient could actually get blood into his legs. But at that junction where you have to sew the Dacron back to the aorta, he had done that and began to unclamp the aorta. And before anyone else noticed, there was a few drops of blood coming out. Now, I was watching because I wasn't really doing anything. I was just holding things. And I saw that this happened, and very silently he reclamped the aorta and went back and kind of redid part of that repair. And the thing that struck me was that this, you know, had he left this be, this could have been a major disaster. There could have been blood spurting everywhere. It could have been a major hemorrhage. But he saw the earliest telltale signs of this and then responded appropriately. It's like it was as if the first surgeon, let's say there's a road with speed bumps on it, mm-hmm. and the first surgeon went over those speed bumps at 60 miles an hour. And the second surgeon knew to slow down. He saw them just a few milliseconds before anyone else did. And before anyone else recognized what was going on, they realized this guy was paying a different kind of attention and focusing on what was really important. Equally good surgeon, same hospital, but this was someone who had a capacity to manage the unexpected, who had the ability to shift gears. That kind of stuck with me. And then later I kind of looked for examples of that in other people other doctors I was working with. And, you know, if they were a psychiatrist or an internist or a pediatrician, it didn't matter. I found doctors who were able to be more attentive and more present and other doctors who were less so. And ultimately, when it came time for me to be an attending physician and supervise medical students and residents and my own colleagues, I began thinking, well, this is one of the important components of being competent.
Right.
And so it's not just medicine, though. It's, you know, no matter what you do, it's the skills and knowledge that you have, but also this quality of mind that you can cultivate. And so the book and what I've been working on for the past 15 or 20 years is trying to describe that quality of mind and also helping people cultivate it.
Yeah, and you state in the book that, and I think this is the same for therapy, that medicine is in crisis. And can you say a little bit more about that, how you're thinking about that?
Well, there are several levels to that crisis. I mean, you know, if you read the newspaper and in the news, you know, there's the whole organization of the healthcare system.
Right.
And you know, we can speak about that in another point, but I think there's another kind of crisis that's simmering a little bit below the surface that may be equally toxic, maybe equally worrisome, I should say, which is that our attention as clinicians is being diverted from being present with patients to doing other things that are more administrative in nature. Hmm. Clicking checkboxes, following protocols. And, you know, clearly some of this is very good. Some of it is real quality control and it's important. But it's come to dominate clinical practice to such a degree that doctors spend twice as much time looking at computer screens as they do with patients.
Sure. Yeah. Which I think leads me to this idea of, being up against that kind of administrative pressure. You also referenced research where you argue that physicians that were more mindful did better at developing rapport, following up on patients' concerns. Their patients felt better. They felt more understood, more connected, emotionally supported. And I think this is really important stuff. And I was wondering if you could say more, even in the face of some of those administrative difficulties, how these physicians are doing. Yeah.
So, you know, I think there are really two levels to this. I mean, we need to fix the system, and that, you know, that we clearly need to do. But I think that given the distractions that we have that are inherent in medical practice, some clinicians are more aware of them and know how to accommodate better and bring the best of themselves given the circumstances, and other people are more consumed by them. And I notice in those who are more consumed that often they're not even aware of how their attention is being fragmented. That they're trying to multitask, but you know, if you ask them, you know, are you really successful at this multitasking? Is it really working for you? They'll say no, but then they'll say, well, you know, what can you do, you know, to change that? And there, a lot of people just get lost. They just don't know how.
Hmm. Which I think you begin to talk about in this book. Before I get to some of the specifics, though, I want to ask you about, you make a great point, which I think I just want to maybe have you share about a little bit. And that's this idea that mindful practice in medicine is more than just meditation and personal growth. And which I think is a really great point, and that being mindful is, and you say this, that being mindful is when you know to stop briefly, look a patient in the eye and ask, have I got it all? Is there more? And I just think that's really nice. And can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, when I started writing about mindful practice in medicine, the word mindfulness was not really a household word.
Sure.
And now it is, and it's all over the media. And I think it's a good thing. It's fundamentally a good thing. But I also think that people have a misconception about what mindfulness is.
Sure.
It's not going to a yoga retreat. It's not spending 3 years sitting on a cushion. Right. I mean, it is that. But mindfulness is really about what you bring to what you do in everyday life. And although I don't personally consider myself a Buddhist, I think that there's a lot to be learned from the Buddhist philosophy that underlies this. Right. And mindfulness is part of a whole package. It's a package of living your life in a certain way that's concordant with your values, that allows you to be the person that you want to be in the world. And mindfulness is about paying attention in a particular way. So seeing things as they are, as opposed to how you would have them be. It's about knowing the filter through which you see the world,
right?
Through the lens through which you see the world. And it's knowing yourself as others know you, and knowing others as they know themselves. So it's really this act of creative imagination that you can bring to your interactions that create a sense of possibility.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
And so for me, I've done meditation since I was 16. That's a long time ago. And so I don't know what it's like not to meditate every day. I mean, that's just who I am. And I think there's a tremendous amount to be learned from that. But for me, the most important thing in my day is when I put my hand on the door handle before seeing a patient and take a moment, stop, take a breath, and mentally set aside what's happened with the previous patient, so that I can be present and attentive and fresh for the patient I'm about to see. And those are the moments of mindfulness in my day, in my life. And it's noticing that when I start feeling agitated or defensive or uncomfortable in some way, that rather than reacting, kind of a knee-jerk reaction, it's stopping for a moment and being curious about, well, what's making my heart beat faster? What's making my blood pressure? What's making me feel a little uncomfortable now? Is it, you know, that I might be wrong? That I might be making a bad decision? Is it that there's something that this patient says or does that reminds me of someone else? Or, you know, so it's a way of being able to offer possibilities, more possibilities in times that are otherwise stressful.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. So, and then in the book, you begin to lay out, I think chapter by chapter, some ways to kind of begin to do this work. And and you start with, I think, attention. And so you make the argument the capacity for attention can be grown and developed. And can you maybe talk a little bit about how to begin to do that?
The best studied way of developing attention nowadays is meditation.
Sure.
And there are now thousands of articles that, you know, in which they teach people to meditate, and they put them in scanners and see how their brains work differently when they're in a meditative state as opposed to not.
Right.
But the real lesson from this is that this quality of attention that people used to think was innate or, you know, just the way that you are, is actually something that you can learn and grow. And it doesn't take a real lot. There are studies of very, very short meditation intervention that people even spend, you know, 10 minutes learning to do a meditation technique. And they find that, you know, on cue, they can begin to elicit different ways of paying attention. Hmm. Now, of course, like anything, it takes practice.
Sure.
But what that means to me is that we have within us more capability for ways of being with others than we might actually initially acknowledge. And those are really just beneath the surface. In my view, in order to be able to sustain that kind of attentiveness, especially during stressful times, it does take practice. So this is not an easy path. You know, it's not like taking a pill.
Sure.
But it also doesn't require giving up what you normally do for a living and your life rhythms in a you can actually incorporate this into the life that you have. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll do two things. I'll tell you a story about an encounter with a patient of mine and also tell you how I teach.
Great.
So, because I think those will be. So this is a couple months ago. I have a patient who has been abusing narcotics since the age of 14 when he sustained an injury. And I inherited him as a patient a couple of years ago on an amazing constellation of controlled substances. Basically, he was on controlled substances in every category. So he's on stimulants and narcotics and steroids and benzodiazepines, anxiety medications.
Wow.
And had gotten into 3 car accidents over the course of a year, probably all drug-related, fired from his job, kicked out of his home by his partner. So was really in this downward spiral and was continuing to request increasing doses of all of his medications, which I later discovered he was beginning to go from one pharmacy to the next, trying to get his prescriptions refilled early. So doctors don't like patients like this in general. I mean, they kind of push our buttons. I've had 2 patients who died as a result of overdoses of medications that I prescribed. Yeah. This is a horrible feeling.
Right.
And I didn't want this person to be number three. And he was lying to me about his drug use.
Hmm.
So there was really a breach of trust. And this is a patient that many physicians would be tempted to kick out of their practice.
Sure.
And I was kind of at this verge, this mental verge of just saying, I can't help you anymore. You need to go somewhere else. Or and then like this little mindful moment occurred to me of saying, well, what do I really know about this person? And I realized I didn't know very much.
Hmm.
I knew a bit that he had an abusive childhood and he had had a number of concussions as a playing football that probably affected his thinking in some way. But I didn't really know much about him as a person because all of our discussions related to demands for more medication and my reluctance to prescribe them. So that was our repeated dialogue over and over and over again. And so I just kind of stopped for a moment and said, okay, I'm going to put aside this prescription request and just get to know him a little bit more. You know, what makes him tick? What's important to him? And it was at that moment that I realized that a lot of the things that are important to him are also important to me. Hmm. He wants someone to love and someone to love him. He wants some stability in his life. He does want to work and do something meaningful in the world. He wants to be close to his kids. I mean, you can argue easily that he's not being very effective in those, but just the fact that he has some of the same human... So for me, this was a transition from being judgmental, accusatory, battling, to a relationship in which curiosity helped me know him a little bit better and actually enabled me to take care of him.
Hmm.
So now he's in drug treatment, he's on buprenorphine treatment, he's using less, actually almost none of the other controlled substances that he's on. Clearly he's not out of the woods, but he's not dead.
Hmm.
And he does have a future. And also I'm able to work with him. But what I do with my students is I'll ask them questions like, is there something you're assuming about this patient that isn't true? Or that might not be true.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything that has ever surprised you about this person? If there was something that you might be missing or not seeing, what might that be?
Hmm.
Is there some way and what's getting in the way of your being fully present with this other human being? And I'll ask these questions to students like in the middle of rounds. You know, I'll ask them, of course, do you think this person has congestive heart failure or pneumonia? The usual medical stuff. But I'll say, you know, what are you assuming about this patient that might not be true? And inevitably, it gets people to be more curious, saying, well, I guess, you know, this is what's going on, but I guess it could be something different. And so that that capacity to light the spark of curiosity in another human being is part of what excites me about my work.
That's
and
great.
I do this about with patients also. I'll say, what are you assuming about yourself that might not be true? And this actually opens up avenues for growth.
Hmm. That's great.
I'm not a psychotherapist. I take care of people with diabetes and high blood pressure and heart attacks and brain tumors and, you know, the whole gamut of things.
Sure.
But these are often the critical questions you need to ask.
Well, and that's, yeah, and I think that's why I think this is such a great book for therapists. I know, like I said, I know you've directed it towards physicians in some way, but I think it's such a great book for therapists. Okay, so and this is a piece I really love. You talk about this is, and I think this is so important. You talk about this idea of pursuing doubt, is the way you describe it, or this act of an increasing uncertainty, which people are very uncomfortable with. And I just really love this idea, and I was wondering if you could say more about pursuing doubt or increasing uncertainty.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I got to this connection between mindfulness and medicine through several routes, but one of them was through an educational philosopher named Hubert Dreyfus. And he developed this level of competence of how people learn things from novice to being competent, being proficient, being an expert. And then in his later life, he added another level above expert that he called master.
Hmm.
And in Dreyfus's view, and in my view also, experts are the people who know the answers, and masters are people who delight in the questions.
Yeah, I love that. Yep.
And I think to be a really good at what you do, and this is not just medicine, it's anything about what you do. If you're a gardener If you're an architect, you know, whatever it is that you do, if you're a musician, being able to delight in the questions, which means not knowing. It means not being too sure. It's what Alan Langer calls treating facts as if they were conditional.
Yeah.
And, you know, under these circumstances, this is true, but there might be some other circumstance under which it isn't true. You know, I can take a dollar, you know, I can take a $10 bill and go down the street and buy myself a cup of coffee, okay, or whatever it costs wherever you are.
Sure.
But if I was in Burundi, that $10 bill might not be worth anything. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't buy me a cup of coffee, and there might not be coffee to buy. So you know, the assumptions we make about the world are all based upon local assumptions.
Yes.
And in medicine, in psychotherapy, in gardening, in whatever it is that you do, that's always true. There's always some condition in which there's an exception. There's a boundary situation. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've been practicing medicine in the same practice for 33 years, and you could think I might get bored, but I don't. It's because I allow myself to be surprised. I mean, the surprises are always there. It's if you choose to look at them. Mm-hmm. And say, oh, boy, I've never seen this. I've never heard this person say this before, or I've never seen this particular kind of rash before. It's that surprise that keeps us interested in our work and actually keeps us on our game.
Yeah, I like that, like hanging on to the surprise and always looking for it. You also, I'm going to go on, you also, and I think this is great too, this idea of... you describe undertaking the practice of presence, which I think is, and you actually start talking about how to do this, but, and you say, and it's basically moving away from observing, which I think you were trained to do as a medical student, and you kind of reference Michel Foucault's writings on the clinical gaze, where you're kind of trained to view patients as a disease or a clinical problem, or even somewhat less than a person. And you talk about moving away from that observing model towards the practice of presence, and I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
I think that when you're present, other people know that. Hmm. And so, let me take a step back. In my earlier life, I was a performing musician, and when you want to perform on stage, you need to cultivate two sets of skills. One is you need to know the music in and out. And if you're a jazz musician, you need to know the tune and kind of the basic architecture and scaffolding of whatever improvisation you're going to do. You need to have that kind of knowledge and skill. But you also need the ability to be there for the audience, to actually bring that into a public space. And I think they're really separate skills. You can be really good in a practice room, but then not really bring that publicly. Mm-hmm. And I think in healthcare, that's also the case, that you can know a lot, you can be skilled, but that practice of being there is something different. So in the book, I give an example in obstetrics. I don't deliver babies anymore, but I did for about 15 years. And I noticed early on when I was attending to a woman in labor that I felt much more comfortable when I was doing things than when I was just being there. Hmm. And labor often takes a long time. And so I'd go into the room and greet the patient, examine the patient, and then often you just kind of want to watch how things progress, you know, what the contractions are like, how the woman's tolerating them. But I find myself, as things got more intense, feeling much more comfortable looking at the monitor or busying myself preparing something than actually just being there looking at the woman who is laboring. And having realized that, I began to examine what my feelings were in those circumstances, what it was that was keeping me from being present. And midwives know this, but it's something that really wasn't part of my obstetrical training. So I took it on as a practice. And when women were in the most intense moments of labor, I would actually make eye contact. I would actually make a point of spending a minute longer than I felt comfortable doing, just being there, because there's nothing else to do. You're watching. You're being vigilant for if something goes wrong, but you also don't want to overreact if everything's going right. So just that practice of presence, just practice of being there, observing myself, observing the patient, was kind of like a meditation. In the same way that when you meditate, your thoughts come up, you observe them. Sometimes those thoughts are very pleasant. Sometimes they're very disturbing. But nonetheless, you make a commitment to be there and let those thoughts either be come and go without a sense of grasping onto them or pushing them away.
Right.
So in a way, that being there with a woman in labor in itself was a meditative, was a contemplative practice for me. And I don't want this to sound too kind of spiritual or new age. It was very pragmatic because when you're there, you actually observe things that you don't when you're trying to busy yourself with other tasks.
Right, right. And I think that's same in the therapy room for the therapist listening too.
Yeah. I'm sure you hear all sorts of stuff that you'd rather not hear.
Absolutely. Right, right.
Yeah. Right. And we know what our buttons are, you know, things that we would rather not. But for physicians, it's not just, it's often things that we can't do a lot about. So as doctors, we're very comfortable if someone says, my elbow hurts and it hurts right here. But if someone comes in and says, I hurt all over, there's no diagnosis in medicine that says hurts all over. You know, it's very hard to know, you know, to know what to do. Or another one is fatigue. You know, I just feel tired.
Right.
The doctors groan when they hear patients say that they feel tired because there's, again, no diagnosis. And 90% of people who have fatigue without other symptoms, you can't find a diagnosis to explain it. Hmm. You know, it's, you know, some of them are depressed. Some of them have some underlying disease. But the vast, vast majority are none of the above. And you can't really explain why they're fatigued.
Hmm. Okay. In the book, you, and maybe this is a good segue into this part, in the book you write about responding to suffering and the shaky state of compassion currently. Can you share a bit about doing responding to suffering and what you suggest or what can be done about the shaky state of compassion?
Both of those words, suffering and compassion, appear almost never in the medical literature. And it's incredible. It's really incredible. In the palliative care literature a little bit, but not much. And I looked in, there's a new listing of all the medical diagnoses. There are about 71,000 of them. And I did a word search in that list for the word compassion and for the word suffering. They don't appear there. And then I looked at the mission statements of 30 large medical centers around the country. Again, doing word searches for the word suffering and the word compassion. The word suffering didn't appear anywhere. The word compassion only appeared in a small minority, and those were usually religiously affiliated healthcare institutions, especially Catholic healthcare institutions. So I found that really interesting, because if you ask any doctor, you know, is medicine about suffering and is medicine about compassion, of course everyone said, yes, of course. Well, where does it appear in your training? And people would say, well, that's really the part of the art of medicine. Well, I know, as you know, I was trained as a performing artist. It takes hours and hours and hours and hours of practice to be an artist, you know, regardless of what kind of art you do. And in medicine, they assume that this art of medicine thing is something you're born with or something that you get by osmosis. And in my own training, it was kind of catch as catch can. You may find some good role models, you may not. It was really pretty random. And so that's what I mean by, so that's kind of the basis or the the background. The second piece is that as healthcare professionals, we're conditioned to recognize certain kinds of suffering, but not others. So we're pretty good at asking patients about pain and where it hurts and what the pain's like. But we're not very good at evaluating the extent of it. So if you ask a doctor, how much pain is your patient in? And you ask the patient, how much pain are you experiencing? There's almost no correlation.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? So you have to ask. That's the first. You have to be curious. The second is that sometimes, you know, I take care of a lot of patients at the end of life. I do palliative care. And And I'll ask patients, what are you most worried about? You know, and you think about people thinking about, well, you know, what's going to happen to me after I die? Am I going to be in pain? Am I going to suffer? Some patients will say, well, I'm worried about my family's finances. And some of them might say, you know, I want to feel at the end that my life has had meaning. And, you know, and so there are all these domains of suffering. I mean, financial, economic suffering for some people may overshadow their own physical pain. And then how do we respond to suffering? As most people in our society, we're, we like to fix things. You know, it feels good to fix something that's broken.
Sure.
And so in medicine, we use medicines. You know, we use drugs and or surgery or radiation or a thing that we apply to another person. And sometimes those things work really, really well, and they're almost miraculous. And but there are times when they don't, when or when it's, that's not really what your patient needs from you. They may just need your presence. They may just need to be understood. They may need you to be quiet and just be there with them in silence for a minute. They may need you to hold their hand or walk with them or assure them that they won't be abandoned. And so this respond, the second kind of responding to suffering is it has to do more with presence, has more to do with being than with doing.
Yeah, I like that. Okay.
And you know, if you want to take the analogy of a gardener, it has to do with watering the plant as opposed to pulling up the weeds. Okay, so fixing things is pulling up the weeds. The second kind of response of being there, it's kind of like nurturing what's already there. It's watering. And the third kind of suffering, I think, is transformative. I think sometimes patients use, and this is not everybody, but it's important to recognize it, is when the illness triggers some kind of major transformation in someone's life. And we see this from time to time. That, I mean, no one, I don't want to romanticize this, no one is ever happy that they got cancer or that they have diabetes or multiple sclerosis or whatever it is that they have.
Sure. Yeah.
But some patients are able to use that experience to help their lives be somehow more meaningful in a way, and even for a little while. And I think it's important as clinicians to recognize those circumstances and help patients build those positive sides of themselves, even in the face of difficulty and tragedy.
Yeah, thank you,
And the compassion paradox, I think, is twofold. One is that, I mean, a really good change in medical education is that doctors are taught, you know, now have communication skills courses and are taught ways of expressing empathy with patients.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing. And we even test junior physicians on their capacity for expressing empathy. You know, it's a little bit of an oxymoron to have an empathy test, but I think it's on the radar screen. People are recognizing it's a skill that can be cultivated. But I think compassion goes beyond empathy. Empathy is recognizing another person's suffering and expressing your understanding to them. But that doesn't mean necessarily alleviating it or having an inner need to engage with another person's suffering in a way that alleviates it. And what we've learned in the past decade is that by being compassionate, you actually nurture your own sense of well-being. So it's in the same way as we're learning that giving a gift makes people feel better about themselves than receiving a gift.
Right.
And so these qualities of compassion and gratitude weren't really previously on the radar screen in our culture in general and in medicine specifically, but now I think more so. And it's also on the radar screen for people who study how the mind works and how the brain works. That compassion and gratitude are these what they so-called pro-social emotions, but they also nurture the soul of the person who is expressing them. And so, in my view, there needs to be more compassion education for people in our society in general, whether you're a school teacher or in the health professions or you know, anything that has to do with other humans.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think it's possible to grow compassion through practice. And the Buddhists have known this for millennia, and they actually have specific kinds of meditation exercises specifically designed to cultivate compassion. One really simple one that, again, it's not a traditional Buddhist practice, but it's one that that people have kind of created more recently is just is an exercise that's called just like me. And when you see someone who's different from you that you're interacting with, you know, to ask yourselves, in what way is this person just like me?
Hmm.
You know, what kind of needs, desires, attributes does this person have that are things that are important to me as well? And in my view, that's just it's a first set of steps in developing compassion towards someone who otherwise might seem really different from who you are.
That's great. And finally, you talk about, and you referenced this earlier in our conversation, this idea of taking care of ourselves too, but you have some ideas about, and you have a chapter on healing the healer. Could you say more about that and what you think about this self-care and what needs to go into it?
Yeah, and I've gone through a personal evolution with this, just to trying to figure out what this means and how it really plays out in our professional lives. First, I learned when I first started talking about well-being of physicians, doctors kind of resonated with it, but the public didn't. Because the public thinks of doctors as members of a privileged class and thought about well-being as joining a country club. And that's not what I'm talking about. And then I started thinking about resilience and the importance of developing that kind of inner strength and balance and equanimity and resolve to be able to bounce back when the going gets rough. And resilience is incredibly important, but living things are resilient in very different ways than inanimate objects. When living things are respond well to a stress, they not only bounce back, they also grow in the process. They grow stronger. So when you walk, your bones get stronger. Okay, they don't just stay like the bones you had yesterday. If you go for a long walk, your bones actually get thicker. And I think that if your brain, if your mind is subject to something traumatic and you're resilient, you not only recover from that trauma to be the person you were yesterday, but also you grow in a way so that you, if you have another trauma kind of like this, that you'll be better with able to withstand it. So resilience is really important. But then I noticed that sometimes some of the most resilient people are also the most burned out because they allow themselves to tolerate more. They work harder and they manage to actually keep going when other people would just, you know, stop.
Yeah. Tap out.
And so I've more recently taken the more radical step of saying, well, maybe it's about flourishing. Maybe it's about really being the person that you can be. And that actually has a different cast to it, because it's not about feeling good all the time. It's not like the cover, Time magazine had a whole cover story about mindfulness and had a picture on the cover of this woman who looked totally blissed out, Botoxed. Right. And levitating. Yeah. And mindfulness is not that. Mindfulness is being present in the world, however the world is, which is sometimes pretty and sometimes not so pretty.
Right.
And so it's the ability to flourish given the circumstances that you're in. And if you think about that, it's not just going to a meditation retreat. It's not just going for a run or a vacation on the beach or reading your favorite novel or listening to great music. All those things are wonderful. They're fabulous. Getting enough sleep, eating well. That's all really, really important. But then Monday morning comes around and you're back in exactly the same workplace, relating to it in exactly the same way. And that's really where the rubber hits the road. Mm-hmm. So the mindfulness and self-care that I'm talking about is really directed towards your relationship to the workplace and being able to flourish to the degree that you can. And here, the workplace has a responsibility. Healthcare organizations, the government, insurers, whoever it is that is affecting your work life, has an important responsibility to help those who are working there flourish. So this is not a paid ad, what I'm about to say, but my son works for Google, okay?
Yeah.
And he just started working a couple of months ago and told me about, like, his first days there. And yes, they do have a gym on site and they do have good food, but they also pay attention to how they relate to one another and feedback and how people get positive feedback about things that they're doing well and feedback about how they can improve. And this is part of the culture. It's an explicit part of the culture. And yes, it's not a perfect organization. I did read the newspaper about some, you know, issues about personnel issues that they have.
Yeah.
But it's still, they put this right front and center as a value that they want to. Interestingly, healthcare organizations don't do that. They don't do very well at taking care of their own. And
agreed.
And so I think that we, as people who work in healthcare, need to learn how to take care of ourselves and flourish on the job, but the workplace needs to create the environment in which we can grow. And currently, it's a little bit more like a desert.
Okay. I'm going to save the 8 leaps that you finished the book with for people that have to go get the book. I'm not going to ask you about them. So, you do offer your 8 leaps of how to kind of do this work and what you carry with you in your practice. That's worth the book. Go get the book, everybody. So, but before I let you go, can I maybe just ask you if people want to find you, how do they find you? Do you have a website?
I do. Probably the easiest way is on ronaldepstein.com. It's really easy to remember. It's just my name.com. And you can contact me through there.
Great. Once again, Dr. Epstein, I want to thank you for making the time. I know you're a busy man, and making the time coming on and sharing a little bit about your book. And listeners, I will have links to the book and also to Dr. Epstein's website on the show notes, so you'll all be able to access that there. So I just wanted to say once again, thanks for making the time, and thanks for writing a great book.
And thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. And like I said, I think you should go out and get this book. It'll be in our show notes, the link to get the book and a link to Dr. Epstein's website. But I think you'll find it really worthwhile. And please reach out to the show. You can always contact me via email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram at theradicaltherapist. Or at Dr. Chris Hoff. You can reach me over there too. And Twitter, we're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And we have a Facebook page, The Radical Therapist. And I also have a Facebook page, Dr. Chris Hoff, if you want to go check out my page. And I think that's it as far as social media goes. And I'm always appreciative if you would go to iTunes and rate and review the show. That helps get us out in front of people. And I'm always appreciative if you spread the word. So, and also spread the word about the YouTube channel. We have a YouTube channel, The Radical Therapist, or just Google my name and The Radical Therapist, and the YouTube channel should come up. Oh, and we have a website. I should probably send you the website because you can get the link there too at theradicaltherapist.com. So I think that covers it. If you want stickers, shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Be happy to send those out to you. And yeah, I guess that's it. So, I'm off to Peru, and I'm looking forward to that, but we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another show, I'm sure. So thanks for listening. My name's Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist.